a pleasure to be here. Given the fact that we are dealing here with a workshop, I was fixing my hair. Yeah. What I will do is I will show you some of the really ongoing work in our lab. So the further we get along in the talk, the less worked out it will be. So please be patient with that. I will do my best to keep it somewhat fluid, but I was simply interested in exposing some of the ideas that we are toying around with here and also get some feedback. Yeah? So one of the things that we are interested in is epileptiform activity that propagates through a network. And this is something we'd like to understand using a software platform called the Virtual Brain that we have been developing. And there we are dealing with epileptic data from so-called stereotactic EEG. And this is coming from Patrick Chauvel, who is the head of the neurology unit in Marseille. In the same laboratory, you find Christophe Barnard, who is doing most of the biophysics, and I will show you some of that also. And then some good friends, Randy McIntosh and Olaf Sporns, who have contributed and contribute in the development of the virtual brain and some of the measures that we will speak about. So first of all, one of the key concepts, let me say a few words about epilepsy and the way I'd like to see epilepsy, or the way I invite you to see epilepsy in order to make it accessible to the tools that we have. Yeah. So you see the little nuance? Yeah. I'm not saying this is how epilepsy works, but I want to make it accessible to the tools that we have. However, this year is, I think, kind of undisputed. Epilepsy is a network disorder. Every brain, also yours, can become epileptic. Yeah? So it's a very natural capability, or a natural type of spatiotemporal behavior that our brains can show. In particular, very often in epileptic network, it starts at a focal region and then it starts propagating out. And in particular, the patients we have in Marseille, typically, the patients that undergo surgery are drug-resistant patients, so there is no other tool other than performing surgery in order to help these patients. There, the notion of the epileptogenic focus or epileptic focus is not necessarily a good one, and that's what I'd like to motivate here. What it is, rather than the epileptic focus, very often acts as a lighter for propagation of highly synchronized activity through the network. So what we have to talk about when we talk about the epileptogenic zone, it's actually a distribution of different subnetworks that reorganize themselves as the seizure evolves. And synchrony will play a very important role in this context. So the way I'd like to get started here. We have a region that starts as a particular lighter, yeah. So which will be understood in this context as a population, and then as the network properties will start playing a role in the understanding of the propagation of the seizure through the network. One of the big open questions is why does seizing activity propagates sometimes through a particular strand of the network and not through another one. Yeah. Well, so far, absolutely no one really knows. Yeah. And just to give you a feeling for what that looks like, this here is ongoing resting state activity. What is being used in Marseille is, and that's different to the U.S. and I don't know about Canada. In the U.S., you have very often these grids that you place on the surface of the brain. What we are using is a technology that has been introduced by Talerac. These are the needle electrodes. These are in-depth electrodes that penetrate the brain. Typically, we use 8 to 10 electrodes with 10 to 15 measuring points in there. So we are able to sample a volume, yeah, and these are basically the time series that you obtain there. So needle electrodes with 10 to 15 points on it and distributed in the regions that we consider to be implicated in the particular seizure. Yeah? Then what you see here in some of these regions, interictal activity with different amplitudes synchronized across different regions. Then you see longer interictal phases, the onset of the seizure, which is very often characterized by a large wave-like structure, and then the emergence of high-frequency activity. So high-frequency will be a very important key notion there, because high-frequency, as opposed to other time scales, it is indeed a multi-time scale phenomenon. Yeah? So that will be one of the key notions we need to keep in mind. Yeah? So that just to give you a feeling for how a seizure can propagate, I'll give you a few more details. The spatiotemporal patterns are extremely reproducible. Yeah? So what you see here is across multiple seconds the evolution of a seizure here over over a time window of 30 seconds. And here you see little zooms. So these are two different seizures measured at different points. And you see zooms in individual areas. And just by visual inspection, what you recognize are different features that occur in a similar order distributed in space and in time. So there is a very strong aspect of systematicity to the spatial-temporal propagation through a seizure. From the mathematical point of view, what that tells you is that there is a most likely lower dimensional deterministic skeleton that can be mathematically formulated as a manifold along the lines of thinking that Randy McIntosh presented earlier, that through a plastic process emerges in the neural space, becomes attractive, and then you have a flow, the evolution of the trajectory, that evolves in space-time. There are variations, of course, that are due to noise, but there is a very strong regularity in terms of the sequence of these spatial-temporal patterns. Yeah? So what you find in particular, just quickly summarizing, there is a lighting zone, and then the a lighting zone in this, this lighting spreads out across individual areas. This is what you see here. Yeah. So this is time. These are the different electrodes, which is resembled here in the epileptogenic zone. And then as you continue, what you see indicated in the blue areas, so the seizure activity evolves, and after a certain time, the activity propagates into other areas that are not necessarily epileptogenic, but are susceptible to get synchronized with the areas that the clinician would identify as the epileptogenic zone. Very often, this propagation actually causes the behavioral problems. It's not necessarily the seizing in the epileptogenic zone, but it's the propagation into behaviorally potentially behaviorally relevant areas that then defines a so-called clinical semiology, which is the behavioral patterns that you observe during a seizure. Let me just give you an example. We have a very mixed audience, so you will see how I will go from one representation to the other. This is an epileptic seizure. This is one of the patients in our unit. Now the seizure starts. Very reproducible behavioral patterns. Singing is one of them. Touching the nose, touching of the hand. Then there will be hip touching. The nurse comes in. And then she will start saying, Bella, Bella. Yeah. Always on the semiological level, on the behavioral level, extremely detailed sequence that is repetitive. Patrick Chauvel, one of the grandfathers of the semiology, can look at this video, read the semiology, and tell you how the seizure propagates in the brain as he's reading the behavioral pattern here. Yeah. So on both levels, you have a strong reproducibility. This is a seizure that you actually just saw. So it starts in this particular area, which is represented here. So in the frontal lobe, then the seizure starts propagating. You see the seizing activity commences here, corresponding to these individual areas. So it goes over here. And then as the semiology starts coughing, touching the nose, crossing the legs, another area starts getting recruited. It that's here in TP, continues to seize, reorganizes itself here again, and the seizure is over. Yeah. So the way you approach some type of this phenomenon, it has a very detailed spatial temporal pattern, but it is in a heterogeneously connected system. Which means we have to take into account the heterogeneity of the connectivity. Bob was earlier talking about the sparse connectivity, and there are very detailed connectivity patterns that may or may not be activated. This is the anatomical connectivity that you talked about that may or may not result in a functional connectivity, which means a functional co-occurrence of activations. Here, you, just as a placeholder, you see this is from Izhukevich's work. This is a very old picture from the 60s. These are DTI patterns. When you reconstruct these connectivity strands, you obtain a connectivity matrix of areas X projecting into areas Y. In the work that you find under the label neural field dynamics, where we have contributed, this is Peter Robinson's work, Stephen Coombs, in order to obtain a first dynamic insight into this type of connected systems. The argument was always that this one way to approximate this would be through a homogeneous connectivity matrix that basically averages everything out, and then we may be able to get some insight into the spatial-temporal characteristics. This is not the case. Yeah, we get some insight into the temporal characteristics, but not into the spatial-temporal characteristics. Yeah, and that leads us basically to the fact that we have to pay homage to the fact that we have a heterogeneously connected system and that we have to deal with this type of network, and that poses certain constraints upon our modeling. Yeah, and if you look at the title of my talk, two of those I'd like to address in more detail. Yeah, one will be what is a good neural population model that we put in a network that is as vast as this one to understand epilepsy, and the second one will be connectivity and time delays. Yeah. So, Randy already spoke about the virtual brain. He gave you a little an idea of what this is about. To address this type of questions, I just I will not speak much more about this, but I'd like to give you a 2-3 minutes insights in what can be done with such a platform. Because it may be useful for some of you, and it addresses exactly the challenges that I tried to formulate in this presentation here. We deal with a sparsely connected system across long ranges, so time delay via connectivity will play a role, but also local connections. We are not dealing with a single neuron phenomena, but we have to implement population models at the individual network nodes, and this is basically what this platform is doing. And already by now a few years, there is a consortium which is headed by Randy. I'm heading the virtual brain effort. Kathy is heading the clinical validation. It's called the Brain Network Recovery Group. And our purpose is to develop this platform and make it available to the community. It's an open source platform that right now, since yesterday, you can download at this point. There is a red button. You can download the first teaser version. So it runs in a browser. It is a browser-faced interface. You can go in there. You log in using your own personal DTI or DSI data. There is a module that allows you to reconstruct the connectivity matrix from your single patient's data based on DTI, and that gives you something like this, a connectivity matrix projecting from one area to the other area in 3D. It is this particular representation here. You can select individual nodes, you can go into individual nodes, you can start editing it, you can visualize individual afferent projections and efferent projections and edit the particular value. Yeah? Very soon you will be able to edit also the time delays via signal transmission from one area to the other one, of which I want to convince you today that this plays a very major role. And then you place at each of these nodes a neural population model. There are multiple population models. You can go into the simulator and you can choose your favorite population model, or you can also go on the vertical surface, and here you see about 100 and I don't know, I think it was 90 areas per hemisphere. You can also go and perform a simulation on the cortical surface, then you deal with 8,000 points per hemisphere. You can run the simulator, you can define an experimental paradigm here. All we have done so far is resting state activity. You see the propagation representing local field potential across the cortical surface, where the connectivity skeleton that you read in serves as a skeleton for the connectivity. And there you can either simulate local field potential or the bold signal, or, as you see here, also the EEG and MEG signal, where you read in the scalp the geometry of your patient and can perform a biologically realistic forward solution. And you can also download it in terms of EEG data and then read it into your favorite software platform, analysis platform. This is more a simulation platform. It's less an analysis platform, but there are some analysis tools available, such as power spectrum, such as wavelet, etc. But there are much better platforms out there. Yeah. So, but that's a little bit what you can do with that. And what we do not have in there, we have the neural population models that we place at each individual node. As I said, you can also do it spatially continuous along the geometry of the surface, but let's look only at region-based simulations. That's much lower dimensional. Typically, the mathematics looks as follows. On the ith node, you place a neural population model. You couple it via the connectivity matrix that you reconstruct from your DTI data. You can scale the connectivity, and then you can have, depending on what type of coupling you choose, you can submit information from one area to the other, where the system undergoes some time delay. Yeah. And there has been a sequence of papers that we recently summarized in a review, where we are elaborating on the major concepts that emerged from these type of studies. So far, it was basically focused on resting state activity and lesion studies. Yeah, some of the concepts Randy already spoke about. What I want to now focus upon here in the context of epilepsy and the propagation of activity through the network, what is it we really need to know here? First of all, we need a sufficiently biologically realistic model for neural population activity that can display some of the features, some of the relevant features, and this is something we can discuss, that occur during an epileptic seizure, number one. And then the other thing that I consider to be most important is when you look at the time delays going from here to here, this is a large-scale connectivity skeleton. The time delays can range between 10 milliseconds and 200 milliseconds. Yeah? Epilepsy is a multi-scale phenomena. 200 milliseconds is enormous. So we have to get an understanding and a quantification, some metrics, an understanding of what are the synchronizability properties of a network like this in the case of time delays. Yeah? Bob, I will speak about this at the end a little bit. I just want to point the direction in which it shall go. So, now the part of, I will speak in the remaining time about this and that. Our first two best shots with regard to this. And none of it, this is an ongoing work in our lab. So, first of all, with regard to neural population models that we'd like to place here at the network node like this, when you go into the literature, there is quite a number of models. One of them that is close to our lab for historical reasons is the work by Fabrice Wendling. But also, aside of this, he did very nice modeling work based on coupled population models where many neurons are lumped into a so-called neural mass model, and there he used some Janssen-Ritt models and is able, this year's experimental, sorry, this one is experimentally measured activity, and this year is coming from simulations. Yeah, how does he do that? And the way how he does it is actually this is the same seizure that you just saw, preclinical activity, and then emergence of high frequency oscillations, and you go into the ICL state. Let me partition it into 1, 2, 3, 4. The way he does it is actually he takes these coupled neural mass models, makes them sufficiently complex. I think he expands this quite well popular Janssen-Ritt model to 6 dimensions. And then he goes into the parameter space and he changes the parameters. And here you have different regions identified in the parameter space. So this here is dendritic inhibition, and this here was somatic inhibition. So two parameters in this quite high-dimensional model that he changes by hand, basically, and goes from here to here to here. And as you do this, he goes through a sequence of temporal, in this case temporal patterns, that change and resemble quite nicely some of the experimentally observed activity. That's a good first step, but it is somehow not satisfying because the question is, so what is it that we learn about the actual evolution of the seizure? Why do different high frequencies come up here? What are the effects that are behind that? And not necessarily biophysical, but also in terms of dynamics. Yeah, these are different types one can question, different types of question one can ask. One is, when I ask a dynamic question, I typically want to know a bifurcation, yeah, because which is a generic mechanism. It still does not make the relation to the underlying biophysics, but once you have the mathematical mechanisms that are involved, you have guidelines in order to probe the biophysics and to say, okay, these are detailed predictions. This will limit the type of behaviors that we can observe. And hence, let's check it in and let's test it in the experimental biophysics lab. That's the type of work that we are doing with Christophe Bernard. And there I'd like to take you by the hand virtually and try to show you what our line of thinking was there. This here is a hippocampus. Christoph always calls this in tuto, because what they do is they extract the total hippocampus, so it's not sliced, but it's not in vivo. Yeah. So the total hippocampus, and then initiate a epileptic seizure. And this is the time series that you observe. These are seconds. So the duration of a seizure, this is the interictal state, this is a seizure, no preictal spikes, occurrence of preictal spikes, seizure, no preictal spikes, etc. Lasts multiple dozens of seconds, maybe 120 seconds, something like that, a few minutes. Yeah. So let me zoom in, and here, no preictal spikes, emergence of preictal spikes, and this is a seizure. Here it stops, starts re-seizing, then it stops abruptly. My motivation here is now to go in there and, as a nonlinear dynamicist, try to identify some of the dynamically relevant features from the point of dynamics and try to see if we could put a hand on this in order to mathematically model it and test its predictions. Yeah? So in order to do so, I'm going through this particular seizure and I'm zooming now in here. Yeah, I'm zooming, so this is this section here. Just this section, 750 and up. Yeah, so there's still a preictal spike, And then one of these large scale, large amplitude phenomena, increase high frequency emergence, then it slows down, and then the seizure stops. Let me zoom in a little more. These are the two bursts of activity that you see, large amplitude spike, emergence of high frequency discharges. In this kind of wave complex, this is a slow behavior, but then on top of it, you have the high frequency discharge, stops, spike, and then the seizure, the high frequency discharges start synchronizing. We don't know, but it starts oscillating quite strongly. And then please note the slowing down here and then a stop. In here, I'm zooming into this part here. Do you see that high frequency, it starts slowing down. Then what emerges is what I like to call sometimes a spike wave complex, which, oh, let me go here. Spike, big spike, high frequency discharge, slow. Big spike, you see it here. Even more, but it starts slowing down more and more until you get to the abrupt stop. Yeah. So these are features that you find as components, elements, if you wish, as building blocks, as primitives, one could say, in seizing activity in the epileptic monkey, in the epileptic human, but also here in this discharge. Yeah. High frequency oscillations, these. The spike wave complex you see quite often, either with multi-spike behavior or just with no spike wave behavior, like in this here in the pre-ictal spike, and the slowing down, yeah, changes of amplitudes. These are very characteristic features. They do not show up always in the same order, but you can play with these components. Yeah. And that's one of the foci that we are having in our lab right now to characterize patients. Intracerebral activity with regard to these components. The way I'd like to understand it, and this picture you saw earlier in Randy's presentation, is conceptually as a manifold in a high-dimensional space, very high-dimensional neural space, where activity gets attracted to the manifold, and then it follows a particular flow. The time courses here correspond to the time course spent in this 1, 2, and 3-dimensional space. You see three time series. And now imagine it shows an oscillation here or something like this, but then this manifold changes very slowly in a slow time course, 30, 60 seconds. So it's a plastic process that may be represented through a connectivity reorganization. We do not know. Yeah? But that's a slow time course that is in there. This is a picture I'd like you to have in mind when we're talking about this. Number one. Number two, another basic concept is absolutely trivially, we could say either the system does or shows a seizure or it does not. Yeah, this is a statement about realization. What you could now ask also is, as we are here in the seizing state, can I stop it through a stimulation or something like this? If I can, that tells me that, and this is now a hypothesis, that tells me actually that the non-seizing, non-critical, non-ictal state actually coexists. Imagine you have a bistable scenario, and the system, and you could say ictal and non-ictal state does exist. And if that is the case for the same parameter configuration, you can kick the system from one state to the other. Yeah? There is a little nuance in there, which is the following. This kick that you perform, for instance, a stimulation or something like that, conceptually, if it does not change the parameters in there, then you have coexistence. This would be proof of coexistence, but no one really knows when you stimulate the real tissue what it really does. It may reconfigure the system and actually cause a reorganization of the system, destroy the ictal state, and the other one is then being generated, the ictal state. So that's a conceptual question. We think it's coexistence for the following reason. First of all, coexistence, if we are in a high-dimensional state space, please think abstractly, then that means that you have a state 1, think non-ictal or pre-ictal, and a state 2, ictal. So, didn't I have this here? No, I didn't. So state 1 and state 2, so that would be state 2 and this would be state 1. As we go through here, this is the equilibrium state, state 1, this state does somehow destabilize, becomes unstable, the system goes in here and starts displaying a high frequency oscillation that would correspond to this type of behavior here. Yeah. So that would so this system starts destabilizing. Then this state does not exist anymore. We have only this state, monostable, but as a seizure evolves, something changes, and we are here in the free in the state where the system oscillates, but this state starts regenerating. There is a somehow slow time course which may be related to the consumption of energy due to the oscillations here, a very slow time course on, let's say, 60 seconds. And as the seizure evolves, then this state that was destroyed at this point starts being regenerated. And at some point, this oscillation here becomes unstable. Click. And the system goes back into this state here. Yeah? That would be a story with between for coexistence and bistability. If you have bistability, there is a state where you can stimulate here, or for instance, where you can stimulate here, let's imagine we stimulate here, and then I can initiate a seizure. But it is also well known that when you're here, for instance, you can also try to do the same stimulation, but you will not be able to initiate a seizure because the cells are tired or exhausted the energy. So here at this point, the system is monostable. Only the equilibrium point exists. Here, non-excitable, here it is excitable. So that's a basic concept. We say coexistence, high-frequency state, number one. Number two, in the pre-equal scenario, you observe actually different types of spikes, and that we also observe during the equal phase that are typically large amplitude and then followed by a slow wave. Here you see it again. Yeah. So this is one type of spike that, and this is a predominant type of spike that you observe. There is also another type of spike that goes into this direction, and you cannot see the scale, but this is about five times as big as this scale here. So that would be a small amplitude excursion, large amplitude excursion. When you're here, when you plot this here in a two-dimensional state space, you see the following. This is your fixed point. Yeah, and then a separatrix basically separates this regime from that regime. When you get across the threshold, you perform the large amplitude excursion, and then you return. And the slow return phase, this one here, is actually this area here. But if you perform a stimulation in this direction, you have a spike in the opposite direction, bang, and then return, and then just follow the slow wave complex. This is actually what you see here. Yeah, you can so that would be a mathematical representation. Actually, this is experimental data. There is no mathematical representation yet. But if you want to represent it in state space, that would be a representation thereof. So these two types of spikes we find. The important insight here is, look at the time scale here. Can you read it? I can't. Could be... let's say 100, 200, 300 milliseconds, slow wave complex. Here, this can be up to 100 hertz. Yeah? We have a time scale separation. If you had the same type of population, there is no way the same neurons in a low-dimensional representation, like a Fitzhugh-Nagurow neuron, a very simple Hodgkin-Huxley neuron, can display dynamics on this separated by these huge time scales. Either you add in other elements to the same neurons that then increases the dimensionality of the phase space, and then they have additional, I don't know, ion channels with different time constants, or you assume, at least abstractly, you have two types of populations, one with a fast time scale and one with a slow time scale. Yeah? It is impossible that these time scales are being generated in a coincident fashion by the same low-dimensional system. At the end of the day, you arrive at a higher dimensional state space with a fast dynamics and with a slow dynamics. You must. Yeah. So this is, and for reasons of simplicity, I'd like to assume we have two populations, one with a two-state scenario, population one, and one with a population that acts on a much slower time scale. If it's physically the same or different neurons, at this point I don't care. It doesn't matter for us. It could be also different elements or the parameter dispersion, whatever. Yeah, they are coupled. And there is an additional very slow process that captures this evolution that may be related to energy consumption, or most likely is, the using up of ATP, 60 seconds, onset of the ictal phase, energy consumption gets increased, you deplete all the ATP, then the seizing stops, and then there is a refilling of the reservoir, and then the seizure starts again. Yeah. Biophysical implementation, I do not know, but there is a very slow time scale present, and these are the orders of magnitude of time scales that we deal with here. So, when we do this, let's discuss the two populations in a little more detail. That's what I just told you, population state 1, state 2. And here, what we do is, this is a very base, this already puts very detailed constraints on the mathematical a structure that we observe. Where it's a little open is, for instance, if you're in the oscillatory state, that would be stage 2 here, how do you stop the type of oscillation? That would be an exit bifurcation, and that would be an entry bifurcation. That is not entirely obvious. However, there are other things that we can take into consideration. Maybe you can see that it slows down here. So that's already an indication that the bifurcation that gets us out of the oscillatory state into here will have effects of slowing down. So these are considerations as first based on first principles. Yeah, this simulation, this is the same system here, but I need a third dimension, which is basically this time series here corresponds to this type of simulation here. The state 2 high frequency oscillation, then it leaves the circular orbit, it goes very 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 slowly down. That's this phase here, and then back up again. Non-ictal, ictal state. Yeah. As I said, the more detailed considerations, well, this is the mathematics that is behind that. In order to slow down the system during the oscillation, I have chosen a homoclinic bifurcation. Three-dimensional system with a coupling to energy consumption. There is a third variable that I call the Z here, that evolves over time and is directly related to energy consumption, ATP to the ATP reservoir. And this oscillation here, the speed of the high frequency discharge, I can control by actually changing the slope here of this mathematical part here, this so-called nullcline. This red and the black curve are nothing else than mathematical representations of these terms here. And these mathematical equations are nothing else than population models. I can derive, or I can rewrite this as a Janssen-Ritt model or as a Wilson-Cowan model. But then I'm manipulating the nonlinearities in there, number one. And number two, we can perform the same story, the same approach here for the very slow population. These are this is the mathematical geometry we recover from the population dynamics. Then there is a using up of the energy through here represented through a mathematically a convolution, and there is a coupling between the two populations. Yeah, for the experts here, in order to turn this on and off, this is through a SNCC bifurcation saddle node on invariant circle bifurcation, which you can generate when you have a population of Morris-Lecard neurons. Yeah, this is where how I created that actually. So mathematically, we call this epileptor. Population one, fast. And two state, population two, slow. Slow time scale on energy consumption with a very small parameter R here that describes the time scale of about 50, 60 seconds, something like that. Let me show you some simulations. Epileptor full sequence, no noise. Here you see population one, population two. If you put these two together, then this is the total population dynamics you observe. Yeah, silent. Ictal discharge, stop, baseline shift, silent. And this is a variable Z that corresponds to the energy consumption, going up, down, up, down. Yeah. Let me zoom in there. No, before I zoom in there, I'll put in noise, because where are the pre-ictal spikes that we would expect here? Well, they occur when you add in noise, because as we approach the ictal discharge, this is due to the phase transition, a bifurcation, and there the system is more susceptible to to noise and is generating the pre-ictal spikes as we observe them also experimentally. Let's look at more features, because I showed you the elements that I used in order to construct this by zooming in here. So population 1, population 2, pre-ictal area, emergence of the spikes. You recognize this coming from population 2, the large amplitude spike wave complex, then jump baseline shift, large amplitude discharge, slowing down of the frequency. You see the spike wave complex, so large amplitude, spiking dynamics, slowing down, stop of the seizure. This is the slow dynamics. You have bistability. For instance, here you can initiate a seizure through a stimulation. Here you cannot anymore. Yeah. So the features that I wanted to have there are there, but there are many predictions coming out of this, of course, also. One of them is, for instance, that you must have this DC shift here. It's absolutely obligatory, else this representation does not work. Yeah, and we were trying to get rid of this until I spoke then to Christoph and said, because it's based on these first principles in terms of coexistence, it's absolutely impossible. You must have a DC shift in there. And actually, these are experimental data. In the experimental data that typically you measure them through AC, yeah? But if you perform a DC measurement, you can actually see this DC shifts, and this is from a different slice, but they are omnipresent, yeah? That when you get on the onset of the seizure, you go jump down, and you see this DC shift. Not always, sometimes it's also smaller, but you find this in very many different types of seizure phenomena. So from this work, not knowing that, we have basically predicted the DC shift. And here you can measure explicitly the energy consumption, as has been done here indirectly, that was oxygenation of the slice, and which correlates exactly, that corresponds to our slow variable Z during the seizure. Yeah. So, and it's a reflection of the ATP using up. This is going to become our network node. If that has the ability to display some of the features that we observe in the temporal patterns of seizing networks. Multiscale behavior on many scales, as you have seen, similar pattern of discharges. There is quite a number of predictions that is initiating now some work of the on the biophysical level, but we can also take it and use it now as a network node population, or as a population model there, in order to probe the network and the dynamics in the network. So we place it in here. Yeah. However, this becomes our network node. The next feature that becomes important is now we put in the connectivity plus time delays. And this is something that we have not spoken about here yet. As soon as you're in a large-scale network, the time delays are important in a large-scale network, not necessarily on a slower scale, but they range from 10 to 180 milliseconds if you imagine a propagation speed of 3 to 6 meters per second for this particular network that we have built from a combination of macaque data and DTI data. Yeah, so these are the fiber lengths. And how much time do I have, actually? We started late. 10 minutes? 5 minutes? 5 minutes? Okay. Time delays. Then let me skip some of these. We're doing fine. Effects of time delays. Let me simply illustrate what they can do in simple architectures. This is the simplest architecture I can think of when we have a system with a heterogeneous connection and some local connections here. Local connections, but then one fiber. Mathematically, it is a neural field that undergoes a time delay via signal transmission. The time delays here locally do not play a role. I just want to illustrate the effects that play a role here. This length is being indicated here. Short, longer, much longer. This is a neural field. Think neural activation, color-coded from blue to yellowish. And this is the time. And initially, I fix a length of the system like this. I just change the length of the system, or I can change the time delay. It gives you the same effect. System evolves. Then at this point, I change the length again, and just the length, and the system spatiotemporally reorganizes itself, starts oscillating. Here, no oscillation. And then again, length change and or time delay change, which is equivalent. Again, another spatiotemporal reorganization. And just to illustrate this, here you see the system evolving in time, and here you see a space-time plot. Now note here, the length changed. You see a spatiotemporal reorganization. Oscillation emerges. In this simplest of all systems we can think of, and we're not even changing the topology of the system, we are just changing the time delay or the length of the fiber. And then again, it reorganizes. So the key notion I'd like to get across here is the following. In here, if we do this systematically, this change of the distance, you obtain something like a bifurcation diagram. And here you see the spatial pattern, the oscillation you don't see here, but the spatial pattern that dominates here. This one corresponds to this one. This pattern corresponds to this structure, this long structure roughly here. Yeah. And what you see is as you that spatiotemporal pattern that emerges here, just represented by the spatial pattern, as you change the distance for the smallest changes of the parameter here, you have a bifurcation. Here, actually, when you change the parameter, the system goes down to zero again, equilibrium state. You can kill all the activity by just changing the length of the fiber, just to give you a motivation. So, and this is only due to the time delay. So what we see here is the temporal structure of the couplings plays a role. I just kept the topology constant. So there is a space-time structure to the couplings. Let me skip that. These are just different representations of these stability diagrams. I'd rather jump to here. How can we sample? How can we map this space-time structure of the couplings? And I don't know yet. We are trying to figure that out. Now, I'll show you what our current shot is at that to work this out. You spoke about motifs and about hubs and graph theoretical measures to characterize this. This may work. However, you also spoke about oscillations and how areas communicate. Yeah. Generally, in time delay systems, time delays in a connected distributed network do not play a role if the activity is non-oscillatory. If the activity is oscillatory, time delays can change the stability and destabilize the system, yeah, for oscillatory activities. And in order to talk about synchronizability, we have to take the time delays in account also. Yeah. What has been done with these graph theoretical measures that it's quite full in the literature. The idea behind these graph theoretical measures is the following. If you have a network node, xi dot, then you have some intrinsic dynamics, n of x, and you couple it through some other network nodes, through a matrix, cij times, and then some s of xj. So this is the activity. This one you want to quantify. The idea is if you have loads of incoming input, if the system is very connected, there is a tendency to increase the discharge rate here. Yeah? So it's important to be well connected. Yeah? That is the idea behind that. When you start, but is that immediately translatable to synchronization? Yeah? If two areas are connected, if you have much input, much connections, is it easier to synchronize? Well, yes. But not always, under certain conditions. The timing of the signal plays also a role. If the time delay is too long, it may arrive in antiphase of two oscillations, and then it destabilizes the synchronization, and you have no synchronization, yeah? Even though the system is very connected. Hence, the notion of a hub in oscillatory system may be absolutely false because they are too far away from each other. This is a paper that has just appeared in Neuron, Kilicini et al. That's actually from Christoph's group, and they identify hub neurons that perform synchronization across long distances, actually in the gamma range. Yeah, I told him I don't really believe that. Yeah, because long-range synchronization in the gamma range, they used graph theoretical measures in order to probe for the hubness of this neuron. Yeah, and there I'm saying, be careful because there may be some other issues. The space-time structure of the couplings. What is the space-time structure of the couplings? And here you have a representation. Take this matrix, plot the tract length across the Euclidean distance, or how long is, across the Euclidean distance, and this is basically what you obtain. So it's never faster than the Euclidean distance. These are basically callosal fibers that deviate quite long from the Euclidean distance because they go from one hemisphere, pass through the corpus callosum, go to the other hemisphere. However, it gives you an idea that you have actually quite a long range if you look at this, 10 centimeters, 20 centimeters. Yeah. When we talk about synchronization, when we talk about communication in the network with no oscillation, that may be a good idea. Yeah. When you talk about synchronization, remember the first talk this morning, you have to talk about converging of oscillations. Then we are here in this ballpark under certain assumptions, like you have done this morning with Kuramoto, weakly coupled, etc. Very often you arrive at a phase oscillator representation like this. Phase of ith oscillator detuning, something like a parameter dispersion. This is a connectivity. And then the big difference to your work, time delay, tau j. Yeah? And in mathematics, the big problem is what we understand in dynamic systems are systems with one time delay, but they are already infinite dimensional. We call this functional differential equations. Systems with 900 time delays, if you look at the track length distributed like this, there is absolutely no theorem that can give us guidance. Yeah? And this is one of the reasons why we are having problems with that. Yeah? So let's try maybe... we can get a better first shot at this, but the basic equation characterizing this is this. If theta I minus theta j starts synchronizing, or at least not changing anymore, we have synchronization. And one thing that we could do, here you see another area, Euclidean distance, what we can do is, and it works, we tested it computationally for the time being, the lengths here correspond to time delays. You can perform a first clustering in these regions. These are the callosal fibers. These are the intrahemispheric fibers. And if you perform a k-means clustering here, in this case, you obtain four clusters. This here would correspond to something like almost instantaneous. And then two time frames for this cluster and for that particular cluster. The idea would be the following. Two ideas. First of all, let's see if we can cluster these around the center of mass with a time delay and obtain some stability analysis of this that will give us some ideas about synchronizability, number one. Number two, synchronizability is time scale dependent. It makes a difference whether you work in the gamma band or in the delta band or alpha band, something like that. Yeah. So there we can use the separation of time scales for individual oscillators. Yeah, and for the synchronizability, go into the individual bands and actually assume a first independence of those. But then you can also, there is a theorem or an approximation which is called rotating wave approximation that actually supports that it's not too stupid to do this. And you can separate the individual degrees of freedom. So as a first approximation, you can do it actually frequencies band specific. It works. When you do this, then you... that was the Euclidean distance, same picture. This here is now for one particular area, another element that you see here, the connectivity weights plotted as a function of the track length. And this picture here is actually a very representative. All the local weights have typically a large value. And this is a track length. This is equivalent to time delay. As you have bigger time delays, what you have here is actually the coupling strength goes down. The red crosses indicate callosal fibers. The other are non-callosal fibers. Same here. Yeah. And the yellow dots are the dots that belong to the same region. Yeah. And when you study this equation, assuming the clustering of the time delays, which then can be tested with a full simulation of the entire system, then you obtain, and sorry about this, this picture here is wrong. I just realized this when Postdoc gave it to me yesterday, but he did not do the simulations long enough. These dots here are incorrect. When you do only this area, he is correct. This is a region where you have synchronization, and as you go through tau, increase the time delay, the system gets desynchronized, or as you increase the dispersion, the system gets desynchronized. That's for a cluster. But please note that the time delay here is frequency band specific, which means, relatively speaking, this tau gets significantly bigger the faster you are in the frequency band. And that makes a big difference. Yeah. And what matters actually for the frequency band is only the total strength of the coupling, yeah, and the dispersion of the neural within the neural population. This one we do not have under control, unfortunately. It's a kind of a free parameter. Here you will see the same plot now, but for all different areas, and you recognize different motifs. Doesn't make sense. Different structures, but always basically strong local coupling, and then shallowing out for long-range connectivity. It's typically much smaller. Yeah. So from these first analyses, what we get out of this is local synchronization can be much easier achieved, going to higher frequencies. It's much more robust against time delays, and the couplings in the large-scale connectivity skeleton are typically higher. Yeah. For non-local couplings across longer differences, it's much more difficult to achieve synchronization, but not only because you're in high frequency ranges, also for the lower ones, because the time delays there are bigger, number one, and number two, also the couplings are lower. Yeah, it depends then on how much connectivity you have, how many areas you're connecting in. One of the consequences for that is if you apply blindly your graph theoretical measures and identify a hub, yeah, if you don't make the distinction across frequency bands and across track lengths, hubs may not actually be hubs when you look at their synchronization properties in different frequency bands, number one, because you have to do it frequency band and time delay specific, and number two, they may be actually hubs for one frequency band, but not for the other, yeah, because again, it's frequency band specific. And the things that we are doing now, we are doing this systematically. We go through the data. We try to obtain a proper categorization of these and also look later on for motifs, which has come in the earlier talks also. Having said this, I think... let me stop here. Thank you to friends, colleagues that have contributed, and to the people that support us with money. Thank you.